This is Thirsty Developer, episode number 56 for Monday, March 23rd, 2009, Quick Basic Gorillas.
This week on The Thirsty Developer, we have an interview about the future of managed languages. Our special guest is Mark Strawmeyer, a Microsoft C# MVP. Be sure to stay tuned after the interview, as Dave and Larry catch up and talk about their first programming language and what programming language they'll use next. Let's listen to the interview. So today I'm here in Indianapolis with my friend Mark Strawmeyer. Mark, can you say hello to the people? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I've actually been a guest speaker on the Thirsty Developer before, episode number 9. So it's
about a year ago.
So you guys have come quite a far way, because I think you're up to episode 53 or 54 now. So
yeah, 54 is published, but this will probably be, you know, somewhere in the 50s,
somewhere,
you know, 55, 56, 57, depends. You know, I'm in Indianapolis this week, you know, visiting some friends down here, did an ArcReady event, and did the .NET user group last night. So whenever I take a trip like this, I like to, you know, find my friends in the area or smart people and do a couple of interviews. So, you know, we talked to Dan Rigsby about REST, and we talked to Mike Brown about WPF. I wanted to talk to Mark Strawmeyer about languages.
Great. Well, and I appreciate it. Hopefully I fall into both those categories of friend and smart person.
Friend and smart people, yes. but you're one of those language experts, I think.
Correct.
You've been a Microsoft MVP in C#
For about
how many years?
6 years now, I think it is, somewhere around. It's either 6 or 7. I don't remember exactly. So it's definitely been a while.
That's insane. That was like C#, you know, 1.0 time frame, right?
Correct. It is. So I have authored just a number of different articles on especially in the C# language, and a lot just about development in general, kind of tips and tricks and just how to stuff take a problem that I face in my everyday world, or a team of folks that are working on a project for me that are facing an everyday world, and use that as material to make sure I share my kind of rule is, if I have to go out and search for it, then chances are somebody else does too.
Yeah, I used to follow that rule that and the way I did it was, the second time that I answered a question, I needed to write it down. And because if there was 2 people asking about it, that means probably like 20 people had the question, and maybe they didn't want to ask, or, you know, maybe they didn't see you or whatever. And that's how I actually started my first blog, which was an internal company blog before I came to Microsoft. And that was the rule of me and my team. It's like, second time you answer the question, you better write it down. And it really got us being very proactive, because even when we answered the question for the first time, or we would try to anticipate answers about things that we were doing, and we would blog them.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, was for me personally, as I started getting involved in community and doing a lot of authoring, was where I kind of started. And that was always my biggest fear, was where in the world am I going to get material? I don't have anything to say that anyone else hasn't already thought of, type stuff. And then I just applying that rule you just described of the, hey, if I have to think about it, it's a problem that I'm facing, chances are I'm not the only one. So anytime I run into anything or someone asks me a question, it doesn't have to be twice, I just take note of it. And then as I kind of run through my list of potential topics, just pick stuff that seems interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people who want to learn things. And if you run into a problem, chances are other people are running into it too. But we're going to talk about languages today.
No, I got us on a tangent.
I want to do a little bit of history about you.
Mm-hmm.
So since we're going to talk about languages, and we're talking about the future of languages, we're going to get into a little bit about procedural and object-oriented, but we're going to talk about, you know, dynamic languages and declarative languages. Tell us how you started in programming. What was your first language?
So my first language was actually something called QBasic back in the day. So this was back all the way to high school. I was fortunate I went to a high school where we actually had a computer science teacher, taught various different languages. So even when I was in high school, I got exposed to QBasic, Fortran, and good old Borland Turbo Pascal. So I kind of got the bug a little bit early on in my life.
There's a generation of us that all started on some kind of BASIC. Mm-hmm. Did you start with BASIC with line numbers or without line numbers?
It was with line numbers. Yeah,
oh,
it was the whole,
yeah,
you know, 10, and make sure you leave enough spacing. So start, go 10, 20. So that when you have to insert the lines between, they had to deal with all that stuff.
So you didn't have to deal with 21s and, you know. Yeah, but my roommate in college was a huge BASIC programmer. And I remember when we, you know, got a copy of like DOS 6, and it came with an updated version of QBasic. Mm-hmm. And we remember the Gorillaz application?
Yep.
Actually, Gorillaz is still out on the internet somewhere. Maybe we'll put a link to the show notes that you could actually get a version of Gorillaz that'll run on, Windows Vista, and I'm sure it'll run on Windows 7 too. But Gorillaz was this hilarious game that tried to show you kind of advanced programming,
right?
You know, on the QBasic compilers to demonstrate some of the new features of it. And this is probably not going to be interesting to anybody except for the people like us that actually played, Gorillaz. You had two Gorillaz, and you would throw bananas at each other and hit them. But what you could do is you could change the gravity, the wind speed.
Right.
You know, there were several variables that you could change. You know, we were playing this game. It's like, wow, this is kind of a fun game. Let's go look at the code. And my roommate, who is this huge BASIC programmer, right, like from the very beginning, that was the first language he worked with, looked at it and goes, oh my God, there are no line numbers. That can't be BASIC.
It's amazing those little crutches that you get used to. So
yeah, well, languages have come a long way since,
it's actually amazing. Not
10, print Larry, go to 20, go, 20, go to 10,
Well, you don't want to discount Visual Basic though, or even QBasic though, because I actually, back in college, which was the late 90s, had a professor in college who actually was doing the digitizer, where literally you put this thing in the air and you kind of click a point and it does 3D, calculates 3D points using all kinds of crazy math. So the thought process was you could use this little thing to actually create like a 3D rendering of an object using all these points. So it was pretty crazy to actually be using QBasic to do something like that. So you'd literally hold this little thing in the air, click different places around an object, and we record the 3D plane around it that you then take and plug into some crazy mapping algorithm you'd created. So it was different. Quite amazing to see what you could do with QBasic at the time. A little more advanced than Gorillaz.
Yeah, I want to stress that, I was talking about, the old BASIC. I never discount, especially Visual BASIC, because, my dirty little secret is that's the language that I write in.
You start, yep.
You know, as an evangelist for Microsoft, like when I'm out doing a user group, most of the user groups want to see things in C# nowadays. So I'll actually muddle through C#, but, usually for small little things of code, right? If I'm actually going to write code for myself, it's going to be in VB because that's the language that I grew up with. And
go with what you know.
Yeah. And what's so nice about, the framework, and maybe we'll get into this, right, is that, for the most part, anything you can do in one language, you can do in the other. And there are trade-offs between the two big languages, C# and VB, of sometimes things are more intuitive or easier in one language, and sometimes they're more intuitive and easier than the other. Lambda expressions, I'll bring this up as an example. Lambda expressions in C# are very elegant, very easy to understand. Implementing the same thing in VB, it looks a little clunky.
Mm-hmm.
They do the same thing, but it's just, you know, all the of statements that you've got to do. It's like,
definitely takes a little bit of getting used to. But so going back to your question, I think that actually serves a good example of the, so you asked how, or kind of my history of what I've done. So I started in the early days with those languages, got into C++ and other stuff in college, but Visual Basic was my predominant language that I started with. So a lot back in the ASP, Visual Basic, and VB Script days even. So I lived through the pain that, you could do a lot of wonderful stuff with ASP, but at the same time as a scripting interpreted language. So those pages got huge, and it was really hard to, kind of deal with and debug. So when .NET was released, even before .NET was released, that's when I jumped in feet first because of the whole code behind concept, bringing that object-oriented style out to the world. And so actually I made the conscious choice to switch from Visual Basic to C#, because what I wanted to do is force myself to go to a different paradigm so that I truly had to start from the ground up to relearn, so I didn't fall on the, the L trims and the R trims, all that stuff that's still there and you could use from the VB days. I wanted to make sure I fully took advantage of all the object-oriented features. So I switched languages entirely just to force me to think differently about
and that
what I was doing.
That was a real leap of faith at the time. I can tell you honestly, because I remember it was like June of 2000 was when .NET was announced at the PDC. Maybe off by a month there, right? But, there was all these new things thrown at you. And, oh, by the way, we have a new language that we want you to use too. It was like, wow, so wrapping your head around all those changes and saying, I'm going to go feet first. And obviously you were successful with it. You've been an MVP for most of that time in the C# language. So, but enough about the past. Should we talk about the future?
Sure.
You attended PDC, so you got to see a lot of the announcements firsthand. Also at the MSDN developer conference that we had a couple months ago in Chicago, you were the featured speaker on you know, the future managed language session that we did there in Chicago. You've given the presentation to local user groups, so I consider you kind of an expert of, like, you know, where are these languages heading? Just to make sure everybody knows, we got to put the asterisk on this. This is, we're talking about future things. You know, some of these things may change. They may evolve as things go on, because we're talking about things specifically. We're going to talk about some general direction, but we're going to talk about some things specifically in the .NET 4.0 framework, which isn't even in beta yet.
Right.
Where are managed languages heading?
So really, what I've learned, and the great caveat there is, so a lot of this I've picked up from folks that are actually, you know, from Microsoft. So I had a chance to actually meet Anders on the C-sharp side. I mean, for anyone that knows C-sharp, he's kind of the father of it all. And so some of this comes from Anders and then Paul from the VB team as well, who heads up and kind of runs the languages there.
So yeah, and I'll call you out. You stood me up for dinner that night.
I did, but I had good reason. I got to have dinner with Anders.
You sent me a text message. You said, I'm sitting next to Anders. There's no way I'm going to meet you for dinner tonight.
And hopefully forgive me.
I totally understood. I was like, dude, where are you? Can I come hang out?
So as they shared, and as I've learned, there's a couple different trends that are really influencing a lot of kind of the future direction of C-sharp and Visual Basic. And the most interesting thing even is to start with, well, we actually use the future of C-sharp and Visual Basic. It's an and scenario. So Microsoft's actually made a commitment of a concept called coevolution, to where C-sharp and EVB are going to evolve at the same pace now. There's been a little bit of a sibling rivalry in the past. Yes, VB's been around a little bit longer, so you can consider it kind of the older brother. But at the same time, they both got introduced into .NET at the same time. So it's almost like a set of twins, which I can relate to, as I have a set of twins. So you've got the sibling rivalry. It's always going on where one language will get their candy. Like, for example, C-sharp, bad auto-implemented properties. Visual Basic's left going, hey, where's my stuff? Visual Basic has always had things like the optional named parameters and stuff forever that C-sharp has never had. So C-sharp, this co-evolution concept, the idea is one language is not going to get a feature that the other language is not going to have. They're going to introduce features into both languages at the exact same time. So it doesn't mean they're going to go back through and fix all the discrepancies, but actually going forward in some of the next releases, there's a lot of plans to bring the two languages into a lot of parity. So features that are in one will actually show up in the next language. For example, Visual Basic is actually going to have continuous line integration. So that underscore character that we've all had to deal with, and the thing I've always hated about Visual Basic, having to put that underscore to, you know, wrap your code so it's more readable, you don't have to put those in there anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of wonky. Yeah.
It is definitely wonky. And there's actually a website now called unemployedunderscores.com that you can go to, and we can
link that in the show notes.
So there's a live site, so we can all go and commiserate with the underscores, because I really fully expect that there's going to be a lot of unemployed underscores out there.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I always called this coopetition, you know, that the languages cooperated, but there was this, like, sibling rivalry, as you said. You know, there was, you know, this kind of one-upmanship. In the first days, in release 1.0, right, it seemed like C-sharp, you know, always had, you know, the advantage. The one thing that I remember I was just, you know, absolutely livid about as somebody who liked VB was that we didn't get XML comments in VB until... Not the 1.1 framework, it was the 2.0 framework. So, you know, C-sharp had this great feature that, you know, if you were developing a library, you know, and allowed your comments to show up, you know, in IntelliSense, and VB didn't have that. There was some little tools that allow you to hack around it, but for the most part, it just didn't exist, right? It was nice to see VB strike back in the, you know, the 3.0, 3.5 time frame with, you know, Link4, XML, right? You know, and some of the great things that they had where you could put a, you know, reference to an XML schema. A dirty rumor going around the Microsoft campus that Don Box saw Link to XML and was going to become a VB programmer. I don't know if that was true or not. I don't know if Don Box listens to the show or not. You know, maybe he can write in and let us know if that was true or not. But he saw the power of this. It's like, wow, you know, it's phenomenal. But it's good that, you know, the future direction is, you know, let's both innovate together and kind of pull these things, you know, in parity.
And I'm sure there'll still be a little bit of that coopetition, because at the same time, while they were talking about, you know, we're going to stand here arm in arm, at the same conference, they were also passing out stickers, I'm a C-sharp, I'm a VB. So there's still that pride of ownership, but, you know, between the couple. But it'd definitely be nice, kind of back to your point earlier about, you know, Visual Basic versus C-sharp. It really is going to be about what you're comfortable with. There'll be some slightly different programming experiences in terms of syntax, but at the end of the day, you'll be able to accomplish the same things with both languages, and you won't have something that, you know, one language can do that the other won't.
And you know who's absolutely livid listening to this podcast? Like the two F-sharp developers out there. So we'll have a separate show on, you know, F-sharp at some point, because now that's one of the supported languages in the core framework. But for now, we can just talk about the majority, the VB and C-sharp, and we'll cover off F-sharp.
Yeah. F-sharp is a whole topic in and of itself.
Yeah. And by saying that there were two F-sharp developers, I'm not making fun of you guys. I'm talking two that listen to the show. So
being an avid Seinfeld fan, to me, that's the opportunity of the, that's not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not there's anything wrong with that, you know. So that's pillar number one.
So the two
primary languages are going to, you know, evolve together.
Evolve together.
Fantastic.
So this co-evolution concept. So from there, there's at least, I mean, there's many, many more, but there's three major trends that are kind of influencing the thought processes of the next release and even future releases of .NET. So one of the things has to do with this concept of, and I'll just kind of list the three and then we can talk about them. So more declarative style languages. So there's just, you know, prevalent out there on the internet, there's more markup style things, whether it's XAML, CSS, HTML, et cetera. There's more and more declarative types of styles of programming.
Right.
And by declarative, what I really mean is it's more of a general, you're making a statement about something that's not the explicit instructions. So traditionally there's been this concept called imperative programming, which if you think about classically, you know, I've got very specific details and back to the, you know, VB with line numbers days, line 10, line 20, do this,
right.
30, do this, is very detailed step by step, you know, for loop, for one to whatever, do these X, 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 Y, Y, and all these very explicit steps. And you have to overly specify exactly what you want your code to do. So this concept of declarative is more of allowing the compiler some freedom to determine the best route to go and to do things.
Okay.
So an example of that would be, you know, we can actually use an example from Link. There's this kind of order by or group by piece in there where, yes, you're telling Link how you want things specifically ordered or what you want it grouped by, but you're not telling it exactly, well, what algorithm to go use when it does that ordering or it does that grouping. You're leaving that up to the compiler or other things to go and actually figure that out for you. So it actually moves a little bit more into the declarative type of world. So there's going to be a lot of those kinds of trends that are going to be shaping the languages.
People will oftentimes say, hey, do this, do this, do that. And I'm like, well, no, tell me what your outcome is, and maybe I've got a more efficient way of doing that. Don't give me the exact steps to do it. Tell me your outcome. I may follow your steps, you know, that you want me to do anyway, but, you know, tell me what your end goal is, and then, you know, let me kind of figure that out, because I might have optimizations that you don't know about.
Right. I mean, another good example that I was thinking in the world of, you know, programming specs. The more experienced developer you get, chances are the less you like specs, the less you want someone telling you exactly, here's how you are going to do this. You like a little freedom to go figure it out yourself.
Right.
And come up with some of that. So it's a very common example of, I want to go from point A to point B, not exactly, okay, turn left here, turn right there, turn left there. It's more just, hey, I want to go from A to B. It's the concept of what you want to accomplish.
Right.
The next kind of item that's a major influencing factor is this whole idea of dynamic languages. There's this little thing that you may have heard of called the internet. There's lots of dynamic languages popping up all over the place.
Right.
It's, you know, Ruby, Python, etc. Even to a degree, you could even argue that, you know, classic ASP, you know, back in the day is kind of a little bit of a dynamic language, more of the runtime based scripted type things. And so to date, C# and Visual Basic, everything in the kind of CLR, the common language runtime, has been very much about managed code. And the dynamic languages, dynamic is all about the opposite of that.
Right.
And so there's a lot of this dynamic language stuff out there. And so there's been this argument of, well, you know, static versus dynamic, et cetera, you know, kind of a religious war between the two. And it's much like anything else. There's applicability for one or the other, depending upon the situation. So a lot of the viewpoint is, well, why does it have to be an or scenario? Why can't it be an and about, you know, between static and dynamic? Why not both? So there's going to be a lot of things. There's something called the DLR, actually, the Dynamic Language Runtime, that's a companion to the CLR that's going to be released, that should actually will support things like Ruby, Python, as well as C#, Visual Basic, Silverlight, COM objects, etc. So there's going to be these binders that actually map static types to dynamic types, which is going to be very exciting.
Yeah, and for those of us who have been around the .NET framework since the very beginning, it's kind of like we've heard this before, because when the .NET framework was first announced, you heard the exact same things. It says, you know, we'll have Python.NET. We'll have, mm-hmm. it was, I think that you didn't hear much about Ruby, but I remember Eiffel, you know, which is another language. You know, there were plans for like, you know, all these different language vendors to support that. And it kind of went away for a while, but the notion was always there. The framework was designed, you know, fundamentally so that, you know, you can, as long as you can put it to IL, as long as you can do some kind of mapping from some language,
right.
Larry and Mark could, you know, come up with the, you know, Larry Mark language,
right.
You know, that was specific to what we wanted it to do. And as long as we could figure out a way to get it to IL, it would work. Right. You know, so if we feel that we had better if statements than other people, you know, we could, you know, create the language there. But why didn't that happen originally? Why did it take the leap that we're at now?
Yeah, and this is purely my opinion on this route, but not the position of Microsoft through all this appropriate disclaimers in there. But I think a lot of that has to do with if you look at, you know, okay, so you and I are going to create LM Sharp as a language here. So in order to do that, and if we wanted to create a dynamic language, we're then having to turn around and map all that stuff from a dynamic language down into the static language world. And so each and every person that wanted to do that with, you know, a Python or a Ruby or a LM Sharp or whatever language happens to be out there, there's a lot of work that each individual has to take on. So there's not an easy transition from one to the other. And so Microsoft taking on and providing this dynamic language runtime, one, benefits some of the things that even for Microsoft itself, things like JavaScript and Silverlight and even the COM interoperability will have a much more improved experience with that. And it, now the framework and groundwork is there for everyone. So I would expect more of that to actually take off now because of the existence of the DLR. It'll be easier for someone to go snap in whatever, insert dynamic language here.
So if I could feedback, what you're saying is it's really hard to map a dynamic language to IL. And more than that, there's some fundamental concepts that are the same no matter what the dynamic language is, whether it's Ruby, whether it's, you know, PHP, whether it's Python. There are some core things, and Microsoft said, well, we'll do the core things, and then you can do the things that are specific to your implementation.
Right. I mean, an example of that would be actually what the DLR does. It's got these object binders that will actually map your dynamic type down to a static type. But the thing is, it does all that at runtime. And so before, I mean, you would have had to figure out how to do all that pre-mapping and pre-compile time, but now it actually supports it at runtime more in the true fashion of how a dynamic language is intended to operate.
Yeah, because when you write in a dynamic language, when you put a variable out there, there's not the strong typing to, you know, this is a, you know, string, right? It's like, well, we're going to assume it's a string, and if I assign something to it that's kind of like a string, it should work, right?
So the most... To me, one of the things that I continue to chuckle about is there is actually a static type that's called dynamic. So if you can wrap your head around that, there is actually a static type called dynamic.
You just blew my mind.
And so that's one of the key elements that's going to involved in this whole DLR thing. And you should definitely start looking at some code examples and things. I know we kind of talked about one earlier of anyone that's done some old, you know, the Office interop stuff where, you know, in the C# world, you try to go save a Word document and you end up with just this mess of syntax.
It's hard.
Just to try to go save something because more often than not, most of the parameters that you want don't exist, et cetera. There's all this stuff that you got to do in terms of, you know, casting objects, whether it's cast to an Excel spreadsheet or a cell or a Word document or whatever. The dynamic language runtime takes all that away. Your code looks just like you would expect your code to do. So all the crazy casting you had to do is now gone. It won't have to be there anymore. So it greatly simplifies your code. And when you start to look at it, whether it's you're working with, you know, JavaScript, you know, your code used to look one way. If you were dealing with COM, your code used to, you know, with the whole invoke method and all those kind of set property, all that kind of crazy stuff that'd show up in your code. It's now just, you know, object.name, object.property. Doesn't matter if I'm doing it in a static language. Doesn't matter if I'm doing it in JavaScript. Doesn't matter if I'm doing it in COM. It's all just object.name.property.method.whatever. So your code consistently looks like it's supposed to look as you start to read it.
Yeah, I don't know if they're still talking about it, but one of the languages that they, you know, had thrown out is that they could do dynamic VB. Are they still talking about that, you know?
Yeah, I know. In terms of dynamic VB, I'm not sure what you're referring to there.
Yeah, it was more like the old back in the old days of VB, like everything was a variant, you know? Kind of going back to that, like, you know, let's get rid of some, you know, not get rid of some of the strong typing, but let's have a variation of VB, you know, that is a true dynamic language. It was kind of a cool concept, and I saw some of the code, and I was like, wow, that looks familiar.
Yeah, and so actually I think some of the syntax will probably look a little different than you're used to, but actually the introduction of DLR allows you to do a lot of that kind of stuff that you used to do, except, for example, like variant used to truly be a variant, and you could mess around and switch the types, you know, at runtime type stuff as you will. And those types of things, you know, won't necessarily be there, but it will do type inference and that kind of stuff at runtime, as opposed to it all having to be done at compile time.
And this can lead to some really interesting things, like, you know, the concept of JavaScript, you know, running on, you know, the DLR and the CLR, and the speed that's associated with it. You know, I did a function recently in JavaScript. It was kind of obnoxious. I was doing it, you know, for the Project Euler thing, where I was trying to compute prime numbers in JavaScript, and it took forever.
So did it lock your machine for a period of time? You got to sit there and wait while it ran JavaScript.
It flat out just like gave up, you know, because I was actually running it, you know, in the browser, right? It was like, you know, it took forever. Right. And then you would get the little warnings that your script is running a long time. Do you want to continue running it? You'd have to like dismiss it like 20 times. You run the same thing in C#, and literally the command prompt, you know, if you do it as a console app, the command prompts back like within, you know, a millisecond, right? You realize that, you know, how slow JavaScript is. If you could put that, you know, on, you know, the DLR and the CLR, man, that would just scream.
Yeah. One of the examples that you mentioned the Indianapolis.NET developers group earlier, and I actually did this presentation on this topic about a month ago, I think it was, before your topic yesterday. And one of the examples that I went through was a Silverlight example where, you know, you can't do an example without involving a virtual earth map and Silverlight. So, because they demo so well and such great stuff. And so actually what I did was I took the JavaScript out of the browser, or out of the, you know, the front end, the markup,
right,
and actually put it in the back end and showed how the use of dynamic made it look just like any other code, and it still functioned just like JavaScript. It was just you could actually locate that all in code behind. And the object binding did all the stuff it was supposed to and took care of all that for you. And so all those JavaScript calls and stuff to go make the virtual earth map all were then pulled into the code behind instead.
Have you posted that code anywhere?
I don't know. Actually, it will likely be on markstrommeyer.com soon.
Okay.
Now that I have that site up and going finally.
If that's the case, because I think that people might be interested in seeing that specific example, you know, and there's some setup steps, you know, with that, but, you know, just looking at the code might be kind of interesting because it should look very familiar.
Yeah, and I've actually got a recording of that entire presentation as well, and so I intend to post that out there as well to make it available to folks so they can either grab the code off there or watch the video that kind of walks through several different examples.
Oh, cool. And again, when you get that posted, we'll put that in the show notes on thirstydeveloper.com.
Great.
So third pillar.
So the third, I guess this would be the fourth, depending on how you consider the coevolution concept. But the kind of third item, so we've talked about this concurrency, we talked about concurrency is what we're going to talk about. We hit coevolution, we hit declarative, and then we've also hit dynamics. So concurrency is the next topic where we've had this thing called Moore's Law that's floating out there that, you know, PC speed just keeps increasing, gets faster. So we as a development community don't have to think as much about, there's always been this concept of parallelism. But frankly, I personally have never had to run into a lot because I just knew that, all right, when I went to buy a server, chances are the thing was a lot faster than what it was a year ago if I'd bought similar equipment.
Right.
So Moore's Law is really starting to tap out though, where what you're seeing is, well, you know, the gigahertz speed is not increasing. The way we're getting the increase now is this concept called multi-core. There's multiple cores that are starting to show up inside the processor. So the actual speed's topped out. We're just now getting more processors. And so the challenge with that is, well, to really get that same increased performance, you're going to have to start thinking about kind of that parallel programming, concurrency, the concept of running things at the same time rather than all at once.
Yeah, and I've actually got a screenshot that kind of shows, you know, this issue. I have a buddy of mine that was setting up a database server, and it's like a four-way quad core, and he had hyper-threading turned on. And he actually showed the task manager, and it actually shows 32 different CPUs. And I was going to post it on my blog that basically with just the caption saying, yeah, you need to be concerned about, you know, this multi-core issue because it's coming fast. You know, just a couple of years ago, wow, a dual core machine, that was like, you know, hot and new, right? And I don't think you have to worry about dual core, you know, because there's enough other background things going on to kind of keep two cores busy. But when you start looking at, you know, you could have desktops with like eight cores pretty soon here.
Yeah, and some of the numbers I've heard floating around, some about some of the new operating systems that are going to be coming about, not to name any particular operating systems, but some from Microsoft that I heard the number 256 even associated with just some of the base level OS, the stuff that anybody might have on their laptop or home PC. So when you think about just your average machine being able to support that many cores just gives you an idea of how, you know, the parallel programming, kind of that concurrency, might become that much more important.
Parallel programming, because I've done some multi-threaded stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to just, like, you know, oversimplify it by saying it's hard, but, you know, it is, right? You know, you got to give a lot of thought to it. Fortunately, when you're using the .NET framework, a lot of, you know, the components are thread safe. You know, so there's, you know, so as long as you're leveraging, you know, the framework objects, but your objects have to be thread safe. You have to, you know, worry about starting them, about race conditions, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Please tell me they're going to make it easier for us.
Well, they can.
That's
go,
a setup,
yeah,
man. That's,
yeah,
you know,
as a setup. It is certainly going to be a fair number of things, especially in the language, from the things that I've seen, that will make it much, much easier. So actually, some of the demos that I walked through show that, although I had a laugh because when I did my demo at the Developer Association, I had my laptop that had, you know, single processor, single core. So it was kind of the awe factor wasn't there, because I walked through a demo that was, all right, here is this, you know, running at non-parallel, and then here is running at parallel. And, oh, by the way, it's the same because I have one processor. So all that really does is show you, well, you're not going to take a hit if you have one processor, but I lacked the 8-way server, unfortunately, at the time.
We need to get you a hardware upgrade.
We need to get a hardware upgrade. So
yeah,
that's what I'm pushing for. But so there is a lot of syntax and language, such as things like for parallel, just different ways that you can structure your code, even, for example, for loops, to actually have those for loops run in parallel. So you talked about threading, which is a great concept that I would encourage folks to make sure they take a look at, because there's a lot of people out there that just have never gotten into the complexity even of having to deal with multiple threading and
concurrency
and locking and all the, you know, thread safe type of concepts. So as an early preview for kind of concurrency as parallel programming, I'd definitely say start taking a look at threading and take a close look at it if it's something that you don't have a lot of experience with.
Yeah, because if you can wrap your head around threading, concurrencies, you know, the natural evolution of that.
Right, exactly. I mean, the concepts are the same in terms of, you know, locking and making sure that you don't have resource contingency and that kind of stuff. And so just wrapping your head around that, and then when you get into actual doing parallel programming, not that it'll be extremely easy, but it'll just be much easier because I have the concepts down.
Cool. That's our fourth pillar.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a good explanation of those. Do you want to go deeper in any of those topics, or do you have somewhere else you want to take us right now?
Sure. I mean, one of the things I guess we can hit on a little bit is we talked some about this concept of this co-evolution. And so one of the next things that you're going to see a lot of in direct with C# 4 and then VB10 will be introducing things into the languages to kind of bring them in line with each other.
Okay.
So for example, with that, C# is now going to have this concept of optional named parameters that, you know, VB programmers have had forever.
Yeah, we've known that for a long time.
It's like, okay, I always used to be able to chuckle at that because it's like, well, I didn't know what that is. You know, those crazy, going back to the word example I used earlier of, well, that was part of the reason why when you did the save as, you had to do .ref.missing is because, see, if you did that in C#, it didn't support optional named parameters, so you couldn't just omit all the parameters that are there. And so now in the C# world, you can do that. So they will support that functionality, which also helps, is in part of what makes the common interoperability much better as well. From the flip side of that, in the VB world, we already talked a little bit about underscores. So some of the other things like the lambda statements, actually VB10 will support multiple line lambda statements,
cool,
like what C# does now. And there's just a whole host of other things that get the two languages much more in parity than where they've been in the past.
And some of that is just, you know, kind of, you know, cleaning up the past stuff. Going forward, that shouldn't be an issue. You should have to go through the cleanup, you know, period, because they'll, you know, they'll co-develop all these features.
Correct. So I think you mentioned XML literals a little bit earlier. The VB9 had those. That's one feature that I don't know C# is introducing, and I don't know if it's going to, but that's about one of the few things that I could actually, that comes to mind, that won't be very similar between the two languages.
Oh, so VB still wins on that one.
VB
huh?
still wins on that one.
Oh, and that is
for the C# team.
That is such a cool feature. You know, if you're a C# programmer, you're totally missing out on that, because it's just, and it's so elegant. You know, sorry, don't mean to rub it in your face there.
Yeah, no. So now Mads and the guys in the C# team are going to give me a hard time. Hopefully, a little pressure for those guys.
We'll have to send them a link to the show then. Well, Mark, that's a nice glimpse. Anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Just, I already mentioned earlier the markschaumeyer.com, finally kind of getting around to getting my own website launched. So a lot of the materials that we talked about here today, I'll have the actual presentation and stuff and the code and other examples posted out on my site, as well as I continue to learn things and more things that I can share.
Yep.
I will continue to post and update those out there for
great
folks to be able to view.
Well, thanks for being on the Thirsty Developer again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Dave, how have you been?
I've been gone.
Yeah, we haven't heard much of you on the Thirsty Developer. We had several episodes where you and I were in Chicago together, and we recorded three episodes in one day. It almost feels like a one-man show for a little bit here, so I'm glad to have you back.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, you know, I'm happy to be back. You know, I've been working on this project in Redmond, doing some Azure development, and it's been kind of crazy, actually, just with the way things have been going, the project. Everything's good. The project's still continuing on. We're doing some cool stuff and really kind of kicking the tires with Azure and doing some neat stuff with it. So, you know, I've been trying to blog the experience when time allows and, you know, go up to daveboss.com, check out, see what we've been doing, and we'll certainly keep things posted up there about what we're doing and how things are going.
Yeah, and this is certainly an exciting time for the Azure Services platform. We just had Mix this last week, and we made some phenomenal announcements about that, some new features, you know, in the platform. So it's continuing to move along, and it's great that they're investing in Project Meba, the thing that you're working on, so that not only is the platform there, the fundamental pieces, but real guidance around how to use it for enterprise customers.
Well, so let me ask this question. Did you get a chance to check out the keynote?
Yes, I saw both keynotes.
So what was the most exciting thing to you during the Mix keynote?
The most exciting thing to me, well, I'm a bit of a geek, you know, so I was all jazzed about all of the great technology things like seeing Silverlight out of the browser and all that. But I thought Deborah Adler doing her design talk on the day two keynote really struck to me, you know, the importance of not only software as part of a technology solution, but looking at the overall process, the overall experience as part of that. And I've been preaching that for a while, that, you know, you as a software architect, you know, need to understand that it's more than just the technology side of things. It's about the overall business process, and you've got to keep that in mind as you're designing things. So right. It was really eye-opening, the story about her grandmother and all the other people that died just because the medication bottles weren't well designed.
Yep. So, I mean, I was actually watching Twitter as the keynote was happening, because I was actually traveling during the keynote. And I remember seeing some tweets come across the screen basically saying that they were really impressed that it wasn't just a technology-driven keynote, but it was actually talking about, you know, design and industrial design, and they really got a kick out of that. So kudos to the Mix team.
Yeah, both days Bill Buxton was on the Wednesday keynote, and he did a phenomenal, you know, talk about the importance of design. He's with Microsoft Research. He's an interesting guy, isn't he?
Well, I was going to say, is it me or is he a little bit crazy?
He's a little bit crazy.
He's very cool, though.
I think that you have to look like a mad scientist a la Lloyd, Back to the Future, to work for Microsoft Research.
Yeah, you have to look like a mad scientist to be a mad scientist.
I guess so.
Yeah, exactly. That was awesome, though.
Let's talk a little bit about the interview that we had with Mark Strohmeyer, because I have to ask you a question. It's the exact same question that I asked Mark during the interview, which was, what was your first programming language, Dave?
Oh, gosh. I can't even think back that far, Larry. My brain cells they've lost it. I can't think back that far. But actually what it was is essentially my first computer was a Commodore 64. I remember the day that I essentially opened up the newspaper, you know, circular, and saw that, you know, Target was selling, you know, computers now, and they're selling the Commodore 64 computer. And I want to say at the time, the Commodore was like maybe $200, $250 for the Commodore 64. For some reason, that number sticks in my head. And so I begged and pleaded. And I think I got it for Christmas or something one year. I think when I was maybe in sixth or seventh grade or something along those lines. You know, it's basically, you could take this, the computer was the keyboard. You know, so for all of our young listeners out there, you probably don't know what a Commodore 64 is, but it was essentially just a keyboard, and it had a one cartridge slot, and you essentially could hook it up to a TV. Now, I had it hooked up to like a little 13-inch color TV or whatever, and then later down the road, I actually got the Commodore 64 monitor, got the 1541 floppy drive, and boy, Larry, I was rocking, because I had a floppy drive where my friend down the street had the tape cassette drive.
I remember the tape cassette with the Commodores.
Yeah, and once again, to our young listeners out there, this was literally a tape cassette drive. You would take your cassette that you would listen to music on, and you would use that to actually save data and play data back. Now, it was slower than molasses, but that's how you did it. Whereas, you know, the 1541 floppy drive was a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, which I probably can't even find those anymore, let alone a 3 1/2 inch floppy. But I remember in the book, the Commodore 64 manual itself actually had instructions on how to program. So the user guide actually came with instructions on how to program the computer, you know, essentially introducing you to BASIC and stuff like that. And I remember my very first program was essentially copying the lines out of the manual that would make this little sprite of a hot air balloon with the Commodore 64 logo on it fly across the screen. That was my very first program.
Wow.
And so
you were doing heavy graphics right from the very beginning.
Yeah, I was exactly.
No wonder you're so good at WPF.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, I should have stuck to that career, I suppose. But the instructions actually showed you how you could actually build your own sprites. Essentially, what you do is you take a sheet of graph paper, and you would fill in the squares of what you were trying to draw, what the sprite looked like. And so, like, once I figured out that, I was just in heaven. I thought I was cooler than anything. I was able to, like, kind of draw these little sprites, basically adding up the columns and the calculations and all that, and you just fill into this program with all the numeric data, and all of a sudden you got your own sprite running across the screen. And then I would figure out how to make it go from, you know, the top left corner to the bottom right corner, I think, which was the default, or how to make it kind of, you know, bounce up and down the screen, fly across sideways, and do all these kind of things. But I thought I was smarter than anybody, man. But yeah, that was the good old days. That's essentially my first programming language, and that's, you know, essentially BASIC on the Commodore 64.
Did you do a lot of poking in your BASIC?
I did peeking, poking, you name it. I did it. I did rimming. I did.
Yeah.
A lot of 10 print. Hello, Dave. 20 go to 10.
I think people of our generation, Dave, you know, we're you know, a year and a half apart or so, right? I think that you know, if you ask anybody in our generation, BASIC is pretty much going to be the de facto, you know, first language that you had.
Right.
As you get older than us, you know, you get into people that were doing assembler language. What scares me, or what not, doesn't scare me, but it reminds me of my age and where I sit in the pecking order, is that I'll ask people, like, you know, hey, what was your first programming language? And I'm starting to hear answers of, well, C sharp, of course.
Kind of makes you feel old, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I had kids by the time that C sharp was released, you know, so. And these were not people that, like, you know, these were kids, you know, this wasn't somebody who was, like, programming at, you know, age 10 or whatever, you know, these are, you know, like developers who now are, you know, working, you know, as consultants, you know, at our customer sites that, yeah, you know, well, C-Sharp's been out for years, buddy. And I'm like, God, I'm old.
That's right.
But yep. Actually, I'll share with you my first language, because I did some stuff with I never had a computer of my own, but I had friends
Larry.
Commodores and Ataris. Well, I didn't have a computer of my own until college, and I did a lot in BASIC. You know, I helped my friends, you know, copy out of the old programming magazines that you would get.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So I did BASIC, but the first time I actually ever sat down to learn a language wasn't BASIC. It was actually COBOL. And so it's interesting that you talk about the graphic stuff that you did, you know, right out of the chute. I mean, everything I did was, like, absolutely headless applications, right? Like,
right.
You know, not even command line programming. You know, I was learning how to, you know, update master files on mainframes.
Right.
So.
Well, it's kind of interesting you say that, because when I got my Commodore, you know, I basically got into Commodore because I could play games on it. And that's what I really did most of the time, is just play games on it. And when I got to high school, we actually had one of our math classes was a computer class, and it's kind of unbelievable that they had this in my high school. I went to a, you know, somewhat small high school in a, you know, kind of a farming area, but we had a class where they taught BASIC on a TRS-80, or is what we like to, you know, affectionately term back in the day as Trash-80s. You know, the old Tandy computers, Tandy computers.
Tandy.
Yeah, that's right.
Tandy,
so
Tandy, the company that owned Radio Shack.
That's right.
Its parent company was Tandy. So
that's right. So so we did BASIC, and then when I got to college, I started taking computer science classes, and the first classes in the computer science program was essentially jumping right into assembly language and COBOL, and I was clueless because I was used to, you know, building these BASIC programs that, you know, that can make balloons fly across the screen. And now I'm working with things like JCL and, you know, ISAM and all this other stuff. And I'm like, I was literally clueless. I had no idea what this was all about. But it's like, you know, looking back at it, and it's like, now I get it. You know, back, you know, with assembly language, you're literally flipping the bits. You know, you're flipping, you know, registers and everything else. And it's very confusing. But I mean, that's the sort of the low level language of the environment. And all this other stuff that we have now with managed languages and everything else, that's just sort of the secret sauce that goes on top of all that stuff to make it work.
Yeah. So one last question before we wrap up, you know, cause I do want to at some point publish this show, right? question.
No, Larry,
I have for you is,
I want to keep on talking to you, man. Come on.
All right. So we've talked about our first languages. You know, Mark talked a lot about, you know, what's coming, you know, in the managed languages on .NET. And I think there's a lot there, but if you were, what's your next language that you're going to learn? Because I do think that at different points throughout your career, you ought to tackle a language that you're not comfortable with.
Well, see, you and I talk about this all the time. You know, in this day and age, in the job that we have, I literally could, you know, guess that I do suffer from ADHD or some form of attention deficit, right? So, you know, it's always like that. What's that little new shiny little thing over there that's catching my attention? Let me go check that out. So, but what I try to do is you know, just being an evangelist, you know, for Microsoft is, you know, we have to keep up on our own stuff, which is tough in and of itself. Like, you know, we just got an email from somebody that was at the Mix conference where they're basically saying, hey guys, slow down. You're coming out with stuff too fast. But in this day and age, you have to innovate and you have to keep pushing ahead and provide the tool bar to build the applications that they want to build. So it's really a challenge, and actually a fun challenge for us to try to keep up on these technologies. So, you know, I've been playing around, obviously, with the Azure stuff just because of the project that I'm working on, but looking a lot at the MVC stuff, but also looking at things like the Prism framework and building WPF and Silverlight applications around patterns. But not only that, it's my attention is not focused just on the Microsoft side, but I've actually been looking at things like Python lately. Python's been kind of catching my eye because I know outside of Microsoft, Python has been gaining traction, and you know, there's some frameworks built around Python like Django and stuff. And I've been sort of keep my eye on that, and when I can, as I kind of dabble in that and just kind of see what you can do in those languages and kind of see how different or similar it is to compared to languages that I know. And the funny thing is that languages are pretty much the same. It's kind of funny because what we'll put in the show notes, I actually was able to find a Commodore 64 manual that had that program that I wrote, my very first program. And so we'll put in the show notes where people can go. It's like, you know, it's broken up to a number of different PDF files. And in that guide, it actually, you know, kind of introduces you to programming. And it talks about subroutines and reading data and arrays and stuff like that. And that's like, that's all languages have that, right? So it's just a matter of starting.
A loop is a loop.
Exactly. So it's a matter of, like, once you understand the constructs and how to build an application, what that requires and what are the best practices for doing so, beyond that, now it's starting to learn the semantics of the language. It's starting to learn the syntax and learning how to best appropriate all your different, you know, implementations of your functions and working with your data and such. And obviously, some languages have, you know, better features over others, but in the end, they're all pretty much the same. So it depends on the system that it's running on. It depends on the libraries you're working with. But, you know, the languages themselves, if you're a true computer, you know, a software developer, and you're sort of a technologist, you should be able to pick up any language. And as Scott Hanselman says, you should learn every year. I think he said like every year or something, you should at least learn a new language. And I'm actually going to take that challenge, and I'm actually going to sort of break it down and try to take a month, right? Because once again, our job is a little bit different than everybody else's in the sense that, you know, we're kind of doing various different things, but we're not really, you know, focused on projects per se where we have deadlines and such. I mean, we do, but sort of kind of different deadlines. But, you know, every month, kind of just go in and investigate a new technology. Just not to really become a guru at it, but just see what it's all about. And like I said, my language of choice or area of focus of choice at this point in time is not only our own stuff, but also Python.
Well, cool. And you know, you could have also learned that on the .NET stack because we've got the Iron Python implementation.
That's right, and that's one of the reasons I picked it as well.
Yeah, that's kind of cool because you're able to, you know, take advantage of the .NET framework that you know so well, but you are learning a new language.
Yeah. If you look, I mean, the framework is essentially those wrappers to get into those system level functions, right? You know, how can I attach to this particular object and do something on the Windows platform in .NET, right? Now I'm just doing it with a different language.
Well, that's cool. I'll tell you my language real quick, but I'll be really brief in my answer.
Are you saying I was a little long-winded on that answer?
A little bit, but that's okay. I'm actually learning JavaScript, and it's funny because I've used JavaScript for 10 years.
Larry?
Yes?
The 1990s called, and they want their JavaScript back.
Oh, please, dude, shut up.
No, you know what? I will say the JavaScript of today is not like the JavaScript of yesteryear.
Oh, absolutely. And I learned I mean, I've been using JavaScript for 10 years, but I would tell you this, that I do JavaScript programming like most people do. As I go out and I find somebody who's got a function that kind of is doing what I want to do,
I paste it in and I kind of start hacking it up.
Yep.
You know, to kind of get it to do what I want it to do.
And now it's easier to do that with like things like Visual Studio 2008 and how you can do JavaScript debugging.
Yeah, and actually, I've been playing around a lot with jQuery, which is another foundational, you know, JavaScript framework.
Right.
You know, we have the ASP.NET Ajax, you know, framework that's part of .NET now. jQuery is actually going to be part of Visual Studio going forward in 2010 edition going forward. And it's amazing the power that you can get and all the things that made JavaScript hard in the past, you know, with this great abstraction layer that they built, that it just kind of all the issues don't go away, but they're definitely sheltered from your code itself.
Larry, these kids, they don't know how easy they got it today.
Oh, yeah. Well, you remember when you used to have to, and it probably still is a good practice. Remember when you had to put comments inside your JavaScript because there were browsers out there that would blow up if you didn't?
Yep.
Yeah. So should we wrap up with a blog you should know, Dave?
I think we should change a blog you should know to basically a site you should know. I don't know. We need a better name than that. But essentially, the blog or site that I've come up with is not necessarily a blog per se, but it's sort of a landing page that I like to send people to based on today's topic.
Okay.
So I'm sure people may be aware of this or they may not. But if you look at MSDN lately, MSDN has sort of been, kind of redesigned in the past couple months here. And one of the things that's nice is that on MSDN, you know, MSDN is basically this you know, mega site of all kinds of content and information. You know, one of the great things about the MSDN site is that there is so much information, but one of the problems is trying to discover information or just to navigate the site. But, you know, kind of based upon today's discussion, I like to point people out on MSDN. You can actually go into the different they have different developer areas. And so, like, if you go to msdn.microsoft.com on the left-hand side, we kind of have different subsection areas, and one of them is obviously broken out into the different languages. So if you're focused on Visual Basic, Visual C++, Visual C#, you can pick those particular development areas and actually drill in and actually get pointers to a number of different people in the community who kind of are sort of if they're an MVP in visualbasic.net, they have links to their blogs and sort of little snippets from some of the content that they posted, and you can actually get entrance and access to a number of different people in the community around those different subject areas. So I'd recommend going to msdn.microsoft.com and selecting one of these developer centers and drill in and start finding. Hey, this is a kind of a good place to discover content around that particular subject area. So I'd recommend doing that.
Cool. So your site you should know is msdn.microsoft.com?
The developer center's on msdn.microsoft.com.
Cool. Well, I'm actually going with a hybrid blog / website. And it's actually one of our coworkers, Mike Benkovich, has a website called binkotips.com.
That's right, yep.
And it's binkotips.com. We'll put a link in the show notes, you know, for both of the sites you should know. Mike, it's a blog, and I think it's built on SharePoint. But really, it's kind of his landing page for his content. He does a lot of webcasts. He does a lot of presentations that are in person. And what's really cool about it is that he's got an archive of all the demos he's done, all the webcasts he's done, PowerPoint presentations, sample code, and all that.
And he's done a lot.
And he's done a lot. I mean, going back years. And actually, it was funny because I sent an email to our team the other day saying, you know, hey, does anybody have an example of SQL Server spatial data in 2008 being overlaid on a virtual Earth map? And of course, you know, I should have gone to BinkoTips first and searched there, and then if I couldn't find it, then ask the question, because, you know, the immediate response from like three people is, you know, go to BinkoTips.com, and sure enough, it was actually on the homepage, not the top article, but it was definitely you know still on the page, because in January he'd done that as a demo as part of a webcast. So the sample code was there. It had the database already defined and everything. Actually, it was, for what I was trying to do, it was actually too much content, because I was like, no, I wanted to kind of learn how to do this myself. I want a couple pointers, you know. So BinkoTips.com, it's a great the place to start with. I know that there are people out there that actually have BinkoTips as their homepage, which is
that's something to say.
We'll have Mike on the show sometime, and he can tell us some of those war stories. But that's my blog/site you should know.
Cool. All right, Larry, let's wrap it up, man.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. Or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstyd.
Now the question is it recording? I would assume so.
Okay, there's our blooper.
Make sure...